Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. In tonight's episode, we'll feature my interview with author Elliot Reed, whose debut novel, A Key to Treehouse Living, has just been published by Tin House Books. The novel tells the story of 15-year-old William Tice, a boy without parents, who grows up near a river in the rural Midwest. The book takes the form of a glossary-style list, with entries ranging from asphalt paths and mullet to mortal betrayal and revelation. Elliot will be at Auntie's Bookstore on Thursday, October 4th, reading from the new novel and speaking with fellow author Alexis Smith. Now here's my conversation with author Elliot Reed. Before we jump into the book, well, I think we have to preface the book because the most unique thing about it, I think, is the format in which it's written. It's a novel that is told alphabetically as a glossary of sorts. So tell us a little bit about that form, how it came to you, what made you try to write a novel in that form?
Yeah, so the book is written as a pseudo-alphabetical, like, glossary. Initially, I started writing these entries, these glossary entries that were about strange subjects that I didn't really have experience with. And then I kept writing these entries that were inspired by, I guess, how-to manuals that I was, like, recreationally consuming online content, how to do this, how to do that. Maybe we think of them as life hacks. Have you heard of these before?
Yep.
Like how to eat an apple properly, how you'll never wash dishes the same way twice after you do it this way. So I was amused by those, and I think that some part of that amusement made its way into this experiment that I started doing where I was writing these glossary entries. And then I wrote enough of them to where I started to see these recurring elements, and that, I think, made me realize that there was a story that was being told that could be fleshed out.
So you didn't necessarily conceive it as a novel to begin with. It was just sort of a writing exercise of some kind?
Yeah. Writing for fun. Yeah, definitely. I did not conceive of it as a novel initially. It was, that took some convincing later.
Because I think one of the most difficult things for me to wrap my head around this book as a writing exercise is how you get the story to come through in this alphabetical list. So, you know, the first 10 pages or so, you're sort of like, what is happening? How am I going to understand a narrative along here? But it sort of bleeds through the entries, the actual action that's happening to this kid. So how did you end up doing that? Was there a lot of revision that came in?
I need
a G entry that actually tells the story at this point.
Yeah, there were moments like that. There were moments where I felt that there was something more, an event that needed to happen in this part of the book. And so when you're working with these, with an alphabetical-ish form, it's a little bit easier to come up with what to write next as opposed to a chapter with any possible title. You're like, oh, I could only write a chapter that begins with C here. So for me, and I think, you know, maybe you have some feeling on this too, like where you're faced with an empty page, the feeling, it's not just that empty page, it's all of the potential good empty pages that are better and have been written in the past and all the thousands of books. You're like, what? So I'm just going to try to confine my work to this smaller enterprise. And then I think that over time that allowed me to continue to write something that had more length. It's a way of, maybe it was a way of tricking myself into writing something longer.
Each section is almost like a little flash fiction. You know, you get a sense of the character and the situation he's in, and sometimes humorous, sometimes heartrending anecdote within each story. So did you think about each one as a sort of self-contained entity as well as part of the whole?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the kid is writing these as a manual by which, you know, one could live his life. The manual of terms that allow him to continue throughout the environment that he lives in. So I could read. Should I read a short one?
Yeah,
here?
I was going to say before we get too much farther into it. Yeah, let's.
So it's like a self. Them. It's a confined. I think I'll read Archaeology because I've never read that one out loud, and I'd like to. I think it demonstrates what you're talking about, where it's a contained entity, but it's also each entry has a very practical utility for him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the form is not in the service of some story. This book is a key to his. The way that he lives his life.
It's sort of a self-help book for himself.
I think maybe, yeah. I think we could all make one of these.
Yeah.
So this is the term comes at the beginning of the book. The term is archaeology. If a man working as a landscaper for the city is digging a hole for a tree in a park by himself using a shovel, and as he throws a last shovelful of dirt onto the grass beside the hole, sees a stone object fall out of a dirt clod, and when he picks it up, sees that it's a spear point made 1,000 years ago by a Native American, he becomes an archaeologist. Professional archaeologists like Indiana Jones or the guy from Jurassic Park get paid to look for ancient artifacts, and then to say some things about what they find, to say what the thing they found tells us about the past. Amateur archaeologists, like the city park worker who finds the spear point, or a kid who finds a black and white photograph of his father stashed beneath a dust-covered chest of drawers in his uncle's basement while searching beneath it for a matchbox car that took its ramp badly and disappeared down there, don't get paid to look for artifacts, and don't have to, if they don't want to, say anything to anyone about what they find. See, bus stopped. So there's a reference to another glossary entry within that glossary entry.
Yeah. My guest is Elliot Reed, author of A Key to Treehouse Living. He lives here in Spokane and will be doing a book launch event at Auntie's Bookstore on Thursday, October 4th. So there's an entry also early on, I think just before the entry that you read, that sort of explains to the reader the project of what's going on here. I think that the entry is alphabetical,
right?
And it explains this is an alphabetical list, but it might not actually be totally in alphabetical order because you need to understand some things before you get to the other things. So I'm curious, with those references, you said see bus stopped, which is a B entry. Did you intend the reader to flip to that entry and read it or not?
Yeah, I left that up to the reader, really. I mean, you could. I mean, I think that try it or not.
Yeah.
Either way.
Because I found myself tempted as I was reading it not to flip forward, but to flip back. So if I had gotten to an entry that referenced something that happened earlier, so let's say I'm reading later on about your character takes a journey down the river and has lots of experiences, and maybe you reference archaeology in one of those.
Right.
And then I'd be tempted to flip back and see if there was, you know, some kind of hint or something that it would help me better understand the story better in that entry.
Yeah. I mean, there's archaeological evidence in the book for this larger book that the William Tice had intended to write, where
your character William Tice.
Yeah. So maybe he intended to write a key or a dictionary that was really completely inclusive of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if he hadn't intended that, then the book would seem like a, you know, false in a way.
Yeah.
Because it would seem like, oh, he's actually telling a story, but he just decides to use this glossary format because it's something interesting. But there was an intention, and I think you see it especially at the beginning of the book, that this young man has a desire to like control his universe by defining the terms that are most impactful, the terms that govern that universe. So you see these you know, links to other terms. And as the book proceeds and finds this story that, you know, emerges pretty quickly, then it takes a little bit of more of a direction, gets pulled into a current more.
Yeah, and maybe we should pause for a minute and just talk about what that overarching story is. So, so I guess give us sort of the cliff notes of what happens to William Tice from the beginning of the, what it's, because it's sort of a picaresque type journey in a way. He goes on this journey of self-discovery.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's see here. He is initially living with his uncle in what he calls his uncle's mansion, which is in this hilly countryside near a river. And there are a lot of woods around. And after a while of living with his uncle and having just these day-to-day experiences that range from stealing dogs to cleaning houses to meeting strangers on the road to building tree houses in abandoned parks that are then busted by the authorities. Then something happens where his uncle, who is a good guy but has some, you know, hazardous personality elements, his uncle burns his house down to try to get insurance money because he has a gambling problem. And at that point, William Tice is brought into a ward for boys and girls, or a bunkhouse for boys and girls who are wards of the state, which he's not really into. So he leaves that bunkhouse and meets a guy who becomes like a surrogate father figure briefly, who's living underneath a bridge, a guy called El Hondero. And then El Hondero also disappears, at which point William Tice decides that the only possible recourse is to lash together a bunch of plastic barrels with rope and put them on a river and float down a river, which I think is a perfectly logical thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, for a 15-year-old kid who is living on his own and has nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a logical place to go. And obviously that episode really has echoes and parallels of Huckleberry Finn's, you know, voyage of self-discovery on a river, which I thought, you know, there are some literary tropes in your novel that we readers recognize, but it's in a very modern format in a modern world that we also recognize.
Yeah. I may have read or seen a super abridged version of Huckleberry Finn when I was very young.
Yeah.
Haven't read the whole thing. I have to admit to that. It has similarities because I was writing this along when I was living right along the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
At some point when I was writing the book, a reader said, "Oh, this reminds me of Huckleberry Finn." So I bought Huckleberry Finn and read about two pages of it and realized how good it was and how horrified I was. So I closed Huckleberry Finn and put it on the shelf.
Yeah.
So
that's probably
I couldn't read it. I couldn't read it. I will though.
Right. Well, you know, it's also not Huckleberry Finn at all because, you know, I guess, well, your character has some parallels to Huckleberry Finn. He's an orphan.
Yeah.
He goes on this journey of self-discovery, but it's also not like that at all in that it's set in a very modern world. At times, as a reader, I wasn't quite sure what era we were in, but then there are some pretty explicit references to modern technology, so you know that we're in a fairly modern present.
Yeah.
I think the internet is in there somewhere.
Yeah, he definitely looks.
He goes to the library and does some internet research.
Yeah.
So it's like
yeah.
The internet exists. We know that we're not in the 1800s anymore.
Right. The internet exists, but the rivers remain the same.
Yeah.
The Missouri River probably looks about like it did, except it was much less channelized back when Huckleberry Finn was on it. There were many braids of smaller rivers, very hazardous to riverboat travel.
But that's what I've heard.
The Army Corps of Engineers decided to change that from a river into a shipping lane, and so they dug it out. Should I read another entry?
Yeah. I was going to say, reading something from the point of time when he's on the raft, because that some of my favorite moments happen. I think one of my favorite entries is Nexus, Will you read that one for us?
I will read Nexus. Nexus, the point where a series of things is held together, whether objects or ideas or life events seen in memory. The nexus of the raft is where the lines come together, the point where the ropes that run around the 10 plastic barrels join up in the middle and form a knot the size of my palm, poorly but definitely tied, knots within knots. This was the spot I'd hold as the raft floated downriver on the huge vein of mud running off in the direction of the ocean. If it weren't for that knot, the barrels would have drifted apart, and I'd have been left hanging on to just one. Thanks to that knot, I was able to float on my raft of barrels while seated on a step stool I'd found washed up on a jetty. I sat on my step stool beneath a little canopy of broken-down cardboard boxes beside a cooler I'd filled with snacks and water and one or two books alongside with my pencil and my pages. I'd also tied the cooler to the nexus, and what was within the cooler remained dry, even when the muddy river splashed across the top of my raft, soaking my legs and feet. But it was hot enough I didn't mind. In those days of floating, I recall being way out in the middle of the water, both shores far enough away to where they looked static, but the water, floating along with me, appeared also to be unmoving, except for the occasional ripples and bubbles that surfaced. I meditated on the nexus, that fat knot of rope that sucked up river water and slowly sweated it out, sometimes even creaking as it tightened. It can be very silent on the river. That knot was alive to me. By day it respired mud water and the sweat from my hands. At night I'd hold on to it when everything was so still and quiet that I thought I'd been stuck in a sinkhole of time. When it feels as if things are getting away from you, I've learned, it is best to tie up what you can, hope it's enough to float on, and hold on to the knot where it all comes together.
That was author Elliot Reed, reading from his debut novel, A Key to Treehouse Living. And one of my favorite parts about reading the novel from start to finish is it's broken up into these little segments, and the contrast between the ones that are next to each other can be really striking sometimes. So, for example, that entry that you just read, Nexus, leads directly into Night Rat. Do you want to read Night Rat?
Should I read Night Rat?
Yeah.
Next entry is Night Rat. A blind white rat that crosses the river at night and boards whatever floating object it encounters as it swims. The Night Rat is a well-mannered rat who keeps himself clean. The Night Rat does not fear you. His life of navigating big rivers by night, see, navigating big rivers by night, has given him a great deal of courage. You will know the Night Rat is coming when you hear his nails scraping along the plastic barrels of your raft. No one can say for sure why the Night Rat swims at night, why he is blind, or where he comes from, but I have seen one come in advance of a storm, the same way horses will run to the cover of cedars, or spring peepers will start to sing in the daytime. The Night Rat is not to be feared, though his midnight appearance will come as a surprise. If you're lonely, you will come to appreciate him. Once the initial shock has passed, after his white fur has dried, you may even wish to stroke his coat, which he will not object to, provided you do it gently. He may show interest in the contents of your cooler. The Night Rat may even lift the lid of the cooler before your eyes, enter it, and begin to quietly nibble on one of the donuts you pulled from a dumpster. Sadly, the Night Rat has business on the banks and will never float with you for long.
That was Elliot Reed reading two entries from his new novel in the form of a glossary, A Key to Treehouse Living. Something that I think is a perpetual issue for authors who write protagonists and particularly narrators who are children. Like, this is purports to be a document that a 15-year-old has written by hand, and you so accurately convey sort of the childlike wonder and the rambling nature of a child's mind, but clearly some of the diction is not
right
within a 15-year-old's grasp. So
yeah,
How did you handle that as an offer, and was it a conscious thing that you thought about?
No. So it's a great question. It was not really a conscious thing. I think if it were a conscious thing, it might have been a little more clunky and weird. I just had to decide not to really worry about it and realize that there's a strong, robust literary tradition, I think, of people who are writing as people who are younger than them.
Right.
And using language that we would argue is not befitting of someone that age. It's not actually like a mimetic thing. They're not trying. I mean, there are some books that actually do try to make the voice
right
similar to, like, you know, the kid who is that age. This is not one of those.
Yeah, and he's obviously not a typical 15-year-old kid. He's really smart and curious about the world and kind of obsessive in many ways.
Yeah.
One of which being he tries to write his own reference book
right
for the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, kids are trying to handle a word. What is a word? It's like an object. It's a thing. It has weight and purpose. Something like a bioluminescence. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why kids will, you know, love David Attenborough. I mean, these are terms that appeal to young minds. They're certainly entering those young minds. And then what is the young mind trying to, like, associate with the meaning of bioluminescence?
You've got luminescence as an entry in there as well, which is,
yeah,
part of the entries is part of that childlike perspective, choosing what a child would notice in the world and what they would be fascinated enough to write about.
Right.
So I think, you know, open any page on here and there's something sort of childlike. One of the entries is a jelly flytrap, which is a device that the character uses to catch flies to feed to his pet fish. And the device is a piece of bread with jelly on it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
We all have a system like that. Now at home I have a cup with a little bit of wine in it and the plastic wrap over the top with holes punched in it for the fruit flies. There's lots of reference to cool natural stuff in there. You know, phenomena of nature. He's thinking a lot about weather and the natural phenomena in the world around him. What causes certain phenomena. He's trying to investigate the causes of lots of events and that maybe we take for granted the way a child might not take them for granted.
Right. Things like a thunderstorm or the way the wind blows your canoe around on a lake or something.
Right.
The forces of nature that you don't quite understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're into books that have a strong natural story and a strong adventure into nature, you know, meeting things like night rats or odd birds or scary things that happen at night, this is also a book for you.
Yeah. The voice is really dry. It's not full of jokes per se, but it is, I found it really funny. I mean, a lot of what happens to this kid is sort of darkly funny in that the misfortune just kind of piles on him again and again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he loses first his parents and then his uncle sort of goes crazy and burns his house down.
Right. Yeah, those are good stories. I like to read those kind of stories.
Yeah.
You know, they're people who have been through things that make our, you know, day-to-day lives seem, you know, slightly less stress-worthy. I mean, the kid is floating down a river in the middle of nowhere and there's, you know, strange currents in the river and strange people who are trying to meet him. I could read Daddies. Is there enough? Do we have enough?
I think we have time for Daddies, yeah.
So he keeps running into these characters, daddies, you know, and I think that we don't know what they are, but here's what they are. Daddies. And he's referring to these things throughout the book, too. So the other entries I was reading earlier, they contain references to previous entries. So if you had read Night Rat, there are, like, references to many previous entries.
Which is part of the humor in the book. So daddies are referenced many times before you actually get to the entry where daddies. You learn what daddies are.
Daddies. A daddy is a false authority. There are many different kinds of authorities someone may talk about, like, the authority on grilling steaks is Bob, or, I'm not the authority on huts made of mammoth bone. though I'd bet money they held up better than teepees. And if your uncle says simply, the authorities are on their way, he is referring to the police who show up when high-powered fireworks are detonated within city limits, when a mansion has burned down, when strangely behaving people wander into the outfield at Little League games, or when an adult at a cookout notices that his or her child has disappeared while playing flashlight tag. A daddy, on the other hand, is a guy who thinks he's an authority figure but is not. Let's say you're in your treehouse playing dice with Ned when a man appears from the bushes at the base of the tree and says you're not allowed to be up there. Let's say you then ask him who he is and why he thinks you can't be up there. If he says he's a fireman but doesn't look like one, and if, when you tell him you're not coming down, he starts to come up the ladder, you've got a daddy on your hands. That's the end of that entry.
And I think that really captures your character's worldview as well. He has trouble with authority sometimes, but he's also at times looking for a father figure in his life and actually explicitly looking for his own father. So
yeah. Yes. I mean, he's definitely trying to see, okay, what are the rules of the world around me, and who is the source of those rules? Why must I abide by these rules? That's an important question.
My guest has been Elliot Reed, author of A Key to Treehouse Living, his debut novel. And he will be reading from the novel at a book launch event on October 4th, Thursday at 7 p.m. at Auntie's Bookstore.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. Yeah, thanks, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. You can find more interviews and special episodes along with archives of our usual book readings at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Windham, and I'm Chris Messini.